Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast, the podcast for serious lacrosse players and their supporters to help further their development and navigate their way throughout their lacrosse careers. And now, here are your hosts, New England Lacrosse Journal's Kyle Devitt and Jack Piatelli.
Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Devitt, and we have a very special guest. Jack is not here. I am not in studio. We are just recording this at the seat of our pants because I have Brown alum, famous Brown alum, Larkin Kemp on the line. Larkin, how's it going, man?
Kyle, doing well, man. Appreciate you having me on. Thanks for all you guys do for the game, both pro and college, and excited to be here and talk Ivy League lacrosse.
Super excited, I think is probably the best way to put it. I know that you've been here before as part of that, you know, 2016 Brown team. And also you've been on teams that have hosted the tournament at Brown's campus, which is a repeat this year. Where do you want to start?
Briefly, we can touch on what I would quantify as like an unbelievably strong and the parity in the regular season, and then evolve into kind of the matchups that we'll see this weekend. But I think we wouldn't be doing the league justice if we didn't at least reference specifically Princeton and Harvard. I think it's pretty remarkable when you look at the strength of the RPI and where we landed in terms of across the board. You know, we have a team that many people think is talented enough to get to the Final Four that is not participating in the Ivy League tournament this weekend. Like, that's a pretty amazing statement with respect to coming off of 2 years of COVID, 2 years where, you know, we barely practiced. Some guys weren't even on campus, weren't enrolled. For the staffs to be able to respond the way they did, and for really up and down, because I actually have Dartmouth as one of my overperformers in terms of they had some big wins. They beat a good Vermont team. They played a lot of teams tight. Harvard is incredibly young and talented. They're going to be a problem. And, you know, Jerry's got that thing headed the direction he wants to. Princeton, we have to tip the cap to them. Their early season wins over Georgetown and Rutgers is actually what mathematically is propelling all of us in the RPI. So we are really fans of Princeton, even though we aren't. And then this weekend, I mean, we have four teams. You know, I think what's so interesting about these groups is I don't think any of them are at their full ceilings. I think all of them are talented enough to win a first round or quarterfinal game and get to the Final Four. And I think that's what makes this weekend from a drama perspective so compelling. Like, I think when you look at the Yale-Cornell matchup, you know, Cornell specifically has really kind of been up and down over the last month. The Army and the Brown results. Then you go to Princeton, class of 1952 stadium on a packed out day because they're celebrating Chris Taylor's retirement with the doubleheader women's game right after. And Cornell through 10 minutes looked so good. I mean, they had so much junk. And I think Yale, what's so fascinating about Yale, and then we can kind of, I'm sure you'll direct get into it on a team by team basis, but Yale traditionally wins with defense. Yale, when I was playing and when they won the national championship, could beat you 6-5 in the rain. And their defense was stunningly good with respect to slide and recover. What's interesting about this Yale group is it's actually really an offensive oriented group led by Brandow. And I think their defense is still figuring themselves out. So, you know, just really fascinating matchups.
Yeah, I think the thing you touched on there is how these teams have evolved throughout the season. I mean, we were talking about it right before I hit record. This Brown team is not the Brown team that started the season that couldn't finish a fourth quarter. They couldn't finish a sandwich in the fourth quarter. It was rough. But
totally,
they found a way, right? Like they found their own rhythm. And they found a way to attack top down, which is something I know you wanted to touch on before we get into the
game. Yeah, no, I mean, to take a step back, like when we hired Mike Daly, I say we, obviously I wasn't part of that, but when Brown hired Dales, you know, some of his greatest attributes coming out of the D3 level was that his Tufts teams always peaked in May. And that regardless of who he had on that roster, it seemed like the way John Donowski at Duke gets credit at the D1 level, regardless of like early season missteps, they always found a way to play their best ball when it mattered. And that's something that due to the COVID pandemic, you know, and a variety of different things, we haven't been able to see it as consistent a level. And I'm just really proud of the staff for continuing to chip away at it. I mean, during that 3-game slide, specifically the UMass game, I mean, we really were kind of stumbling and bumbling. I think the biggest thing is that we've simplified our offense. We're a midfield oriented group. Ryan Augheven initiates, he can beat poles, and specifically Reed Moschietti, Griffin King, Jack Kelly, who's really a freshman, and I think he's a sophomore academically. You know, when you simplify lacrosse and you say, listen, you got to beat a short stick, you got to initiate our offense. And then with, you know, money pop throwbacks and split rolls and, you know, what we're really good at, I think now, our attack group of McLean, Glavin, and Antonelli, they are all people who can make you pay if you give them a sliver of an inch inside. So if as you clear through and your guy becomes hot, similar to like inside box game and kind of what typically Canadians get credit for. I mean, Devin McClain is putting up 70 points this year without dodging a pull. I mean, that is remarkable in this league, especially a league that's as talented as they are defensively. And then I think the other thing, and I give John Schveck a ton of credit, we've really buttoned up defensively. Like heading into this season, and to call them out specifically, I thought Trevor Yeboah-Cody and George Pike had a chance to be the best rope unit in terms of like short stick D mid feet in the league. And I think they've really shown over the last couple of weeks, like we don't really get beat as consistently as other teams do at the short stick D mid position. And that gives us an ability to kind of trust our pulls and force people to dodge our number one. And then how can you not bring up the people's goalie? I mean, the people's goalie over the last month has totally flipped the script. I mean, I went to the Harvard game in the rain where Mullen totally outplayed him. I think 18 saves to 8. We lost by 1. Since that moment, he's been stunningly good. Like Cornell, who just filled the net against Princeton, couldn't get something by him. Like he was really, really good. And you know, they deserve to host. And this weekend in Providence will be absolutely rocking.
Yeah, absolutely. I think Terrio, man, you know, I know his dad, who's the head coach at Keene State, Mark Terrio. And I did a little piece on him and then Jack Piatelli's son, who I do the podcast with, John Piatelli's on Cornell, and they played against each other. And I was like, I think they might both have good games. And then they did, you know, right. It was one of those things where actually the narrative works out, where if you work in media, let me tell you something, this season, the narrative never worked. So right. even you and I talking about these games, these amazing, you know, Cornell, Yale and Brown versus Penn. Whatever we say we think is going to happen probably isn't going to happen. That's how little faith I have in it. Right. I do want to elaborate a little bit more on one player, especially that has really come to the fore in the last three games. Remo Eshedi, this dude and his connection with Augerman is insane.
Totally.
I mean, gave him the natural hat trick in the last game. Like it's so key to see, you know, this Brown team manipulates slides really well on offense, and it's because of their cutting and their off ball movement. And then the top guys, you know, you mentioned beating a short stick. Sometimes they don't even have to beat them. They just need a step. And then the kind of rocker step away to get the pass off is incredible for this whole group. And I think once they unlock that, that's kind of been the key to their victory, as well as, you know, obviously the up and down style of, you know, Mike Daly and Brown is always going to be present when you're talking about the Bears, right?
Totally. I mean, to touch on Moshe Eddie, I think what people, it perhaps doesn't come across on film, he is a monster. Like when you see him at the tailgate, like he is NFL sized. And as a former LSM, I can tell you, you know, when you have that type of like basketball size and athleticism, there's just always an urgency to hedge early and to be in a position to slide with force and with body to kind of what I would quantify as like a slower stagnating like rocker dodge. And because of that, you touched on it perfectly, he doesn't need to blow by his guy to gain the space required to initiate our offense and force teams to rotate and hedge. And, you know, to give credit to the entire midfield group, our turnover efficiency has gone way up. Like we, all four guys, when we kind of play four high now on some of that throwback stuff, really the only way we get stopped is a save. Like Moshe Eddie almost never turns the ball over. Griffin King is like the son of a coach. He also doesn't turn the ball over ever. Augerman, the only time anyone stops him is a big save when he's just a little bit off shooting. And to give Penn credit, it's going to be a hell of a matchup because this BJ Farrar kid, he pops on film. He's really good and he's going to play Augie tough. That's a big boy. That's a pro type matchup. And their short sticks are super athletic as well. I mean, but this is why you play, right? It's why you come to a place like Brown. You know, hopefully Reed can play well on Friday night.
All right, let's jump into the first game.
Yep.
Yale versus Cornell. Let's look at kind of some of the things that stick out to you for Cornell offensively. What do you think?
Yeah, totally. So let's start when they're really going, Piatelli's borderline unguardable and cursed. And everyone else plays off that and uses the space that he creates to be able to blow by their guy. Like when Kirst is really going and they have the left high wing and they can also dodge out of the low right wing with Piatelli, they're just really, really hard to guard. Like they're super athletic. They have a combination of jitterbugs and kind of big, strong kids. And when they're confident, like I think people sometimes forget, I mean, they beat Ohio State handily in at a time when Ohio State was playing really well. And other than the Army and the Brown results, like they've been rock solid across the board. Like they beat up on Yale. Yale came back late, but they beat up on them pretty good up until the end of the third quarter. And anyone who watched the first quarter of the Princeton game on Saturday, like they were electric. Like they were filling the net. They're a lot to handle. And when Piatelli's dodging with confidence and shooting with confidence, and Yale's going to have to respect that. I mean, Chris Fake, candidly, and I say this with the utmost respect, I don't think he's as good this year as he was in 18-19. I'm not sure if he's nursing an injury. He was like special as a freshman. He was really, really hard to beat one-on-one, but my expectation is they're going to have to help him a little bit on Friday night. And that should lead to South North, you know, feeding lanes and step downs for some of those middies who can fill it. So I honestly think Buse doesn't hate the matchup. Like Yale has been so good defensively for so long, but this year that is not the strength of that team.
Yeah, I think with Cornell, the key to them getting rolling is getting the lead, right? Like this is a team that loves to play up, right? Like they can come back. They've shown that in a couple games. I mean, even the Dartmouth game is the perfect example of them when their shooters aren't on.
Yep.
They have to find another way to grind and keep it close. And, you know, Gavin Adler might be one of the best poles in D1.
Easily.
And no one saw it. Like the weird thing is, as someone that covers this season specifically with Ivy League and even a lot of other parts of the college team, but definitely Ivy and even NESCAC to a certain degree, the rosters were not predictable,
right?
Because you had guys that took 2 years off. You had guys that you know, didn't play at all, and you don't know if they're coming back, and you don't know how they've developed. You don't know if they're going to knock off some rust. And I think we saw that early on with some of those early results, specifically with Yale, actually, where they were better than the team they were playing, but it looked bad for long stretches. And I think that's actually almost every team. And somehow that's the most miraculous thing about all of this that people aren't really paying attention to as a story. No one knew how this was going to go.
Right.
And now it's actually gone better than anyone could have possibly predicted. And specifically, specifically for Cornell, the way that they've been able to incorporate the swing directly from wing to wing through X has really opened up defenses, because defenses tried to shade Piatelli and they tried to shade the other side. And guys like Coyle and Kelleher have actually been key to just moving the ball. Like if you counted second assists for this Cornell team, those two guys might be way, like their assist total would double.
Really well said. And this is where you give Jeff Teat credit and really like the decade of kind of Canadian influence that Cornell's received. East-West skip lanes like define the indoor game. Like they're basically everything. And just practicing with a player of that caliber for that long, it becomes a part of who you are. So when you touch on kind of the wing to wing and the rate at which they transfer, it's just faster than other teams, and it forces slides to become longer and low fills to become higher and all the different things you want as an offensive coordinator. So I think regardless of who graduates and Donville and Teat move on, there's still that type of Canadian feel where, to your point, they just space it better than a lot of teams do. All these American kids who grow up inside, there's a tendency to kind of get into that natural like 1-4-1 type position after a clear through. And Canadians just do a way, way better job of kind of more of like a nation's pairs look. And to touch on the Adler piece, why I think people need to realize that Cornell is in a very favorable position. Brandow is the trigger for Yale.
Yeah.
Cornell has the perfect kryptonite to Brandow. Gavin Adler is arguably the best player in the league. Like if you took away the tendency for like league awards to go to offensive players, like he is having a crazy season. Like people don't even go near him on film, and he still has like 3 cost turnovers a game. If you remember that first matchup, there's like 10 seconds left. Andy Shea gives the ball to Brandow on the low wing. Gavin Adler like literally eats his lunch. He looks like it's like high school film from like Tucker Durkin. Like it's really impressive. And I expect him to be a huge part of this equation come Friday, because, and I'm not saying he can't do it, for Yale to win, in my opinion, Brandow needs to have a special type performance against a very good first team All-American quality poll. If not, just I think like mathematically and rationally, you have to lean towards a Cornell group that's a little more balanced. They're a little more balanced in how they initiate and in the strength of the team.
Right. And I think that if we're talking about strengths and weaknesses, right?
Yeah.
Neutralizing Brandao is key, but he's not the only guy. This Chris Lyons kid, he didn't come out of nowhere. You know, he was well respected. He was a ranked recruit. But yep. Will Cabrera. Wow. How white am I? Will Cabrera actually started most of the games for Yale at the beginning. And then Lyons gets healthy and he just is the extra spark to go with the calming influence of another freshman in Leo Johnson to settle that attack. And the thing that I like about Yale is that, you know, we just talked a lot about Cornell shooters and guys with step downs. Yale is, these guys like Thomas Bragg is built for step downs.
They could shoot. I mean? Totally. Like, Yale, like, just to go back a little bit, ever since Michael Kesey, they've had step down guys. Like Eric Scott could shoot the hell out of the rock. They've had guys who can fill it. And Brandao never turns the ball over. So he, right. if you have to slide to him, if you have to slide to Johnson or Lyons, or if you have to slide really anything, there's going to be South North skip, you know, skip lanes, and guys like Bragg are going to be stepping in, and he's good from 15. So there's no question Yale has the pieces. I just think philosophically at the highest level, when you're going to bed as Cornell's D coordinator, Jordan Stevens, like we rest on the fact that I think you can put Adler on an island. I think you can almost tell your guys, force him to go 3-2 and beat us. Like if he beats Gavin Adler for 3 goals, fine. Yeah. We just can't let him get those hockey assists and get those easy step downs on the backside to cut some of the guys you were naming. Cause that's when Yale finds their pace. And that's when they really get going.
Yeah. And another thing Yale's kind of transitioned into doing, part of their evolution as an offense, is moving Brandao around.
Right.
He's not just the guy that sits at X. He's not the guy that sits on the wing. They've been actually putting him on the crease and seeing where the slide comes from and then moving him into advantageous positions to exploit that. And then when the game's on the line, obviously he's getting the ball. But Leo Johnson and Chris Lyons have done an incredible job of managing the offense when they're trying to figure out where to put Brandao. Brandao, they'll do it sometimes to try and get Brandao a shorty, and it doesn't work anymore because teams figured that out. But when they were doing it and it was working, they were setting down screens and he was just popping out, it was a goal. Like every time it was a goal. And you know, if I'm looking at a key to victory that isn't Brandao and isn't the attack, it's Brian Tevlin. Because when Tevlin has played well, Yale wins. When he doesn't play well, they don't win.
No, that's absolutely right. I mean, what I'd expect Andy to do is he's going to clear through Brandao fairly consistently, force Adler to be the hot guy. And to your point, guys like Tevlin need to initiate early and often and draw slides. And that's when they'll get the offense firing and the defense spinning. I mean, that's just the key to any game. And especially when you play a team the second time, when everyone has more familiarity with the sets and the personnel, and there's going to be less helter-skelter goals. Like, goals got to be earned in big rivalry matchups and conference tournaments. And you're totally right. I mean, Tevlin has the ability to fill the net. I think he's on Team USA. Like, he has the talent and the upside to beat a short stick, and he needs to do that on Friday night. I mean, there's no question about it. I think what will be fascinating, and I'm interested to see what Stevens does, is whether he switches everything or whether he gets matchups through and forces Yale to shoot on the run. I think something that Lars used to believe in, and I certainly believe in it, is like, to a degree, even if they get good looks, it actually helps to force Yale to beat you on the run. Like, if you go a little bit slower to slide and you kind of show no go and just force them to beat you down the alley. Like, if they stick it off pipe, they do it. What you don't want, because they almost never turn it over, they never really jam crease, is you don't want them to be able to throw forward and then look through your defense while you're trying to recover and rotate. Because that's when they get, like when we were playing, it was 44 God debt. That's when they get the dunks. And you don't want them to get that.
Yeah. The other thing they do defensively is they send the back check.
Oh yeah.
So if Cornell isn't going to do this because they're more of a team offense, but if you're trying to get an ISO with 20 seconds left, they're covering the farthest guy. They're uncovering the farthest guy and sending him inside so you can't jam it. And they're sending the topside guy behind you to like try and take that ball away. Like, I've seen him do it 100 times. It doesn't always work, but it's distracting to the ball carry. It's distracting to the offense, and it messes people up. And that's one thing. If I'm, I mean, we're not getting to picks just yet, But the intangibles for me kind of lie with Shea, because I know he's a great game planner. Even like he has game plans for when the first game plan doesn't work, and then he has a third one just in his back pocket on a piece of paper. Like that's just how the dude prepares. And totally. I think there's something to be said for that, right? And again, I mentioned Tevlin as the secret weapon here, but really, I mean, you can't say enough about how Paquette has done in net. I mean, he makes saves look easy. So I think like actually Terrio is very similar. Like he makes saves look easy that are not easy. You know, great. Like people take that shot high on both of those goalies and thinking they have that corner free, right? That little corner that you can kind of pick if you're a really good shooter, and it's not free, right? You have to change planes. And I mean, I sound like a youth coach. You have to change planes if you want to score on these guys or get a crazy power shot. And I think kind of, you know, looking at both how both those guys impact their teams, it's
agreed. I think Cornell Yale is a fascinating goalie matchup, because I would quantify it as my prediction would be one of them gets hot and kind of like outperforms his season index, because they're a little bit streaky. I think they're both leaners. Like they're not super fundamental in their consistency game by game, but they both have the ability to make saves that they shouldn't. And I think Erlin in particular has been up and down. Like he got pulled from two straight. Yeah. He wasn't particularly great against Cuse, although they obviously can shoot the shit out of the ball. If one of them can steal some possessions early and get to a point where they allow their team to build kind of that lead that you touched on earlier and play from the front, I think that'll be a huge trigger. So that it's the matchup at the dot, which I think will be fascinating. I think Yale's clamper's a touch better, but Cornell's guy, I think, was pretty good against him when they played the first go round. So I think that'll be fascinating. It's obviously going to be a big boy wing play matchup. I mean, there's great athletes on both sides, you know, like 50-50 ground balls win rivalry games. And then the goalies. I mean, if someone can get above 50 and stay there, it'll just be huge in terms of empty possessions.
Yeah. I think Yale also has more guys to throw at Petrakis. Like they just do, have sure. more. They've got four guys that have taken more than, you know, 30 draws this season. So I think, you know, and talking to Cornell fans, I do a podcast with one of them. He's, you know, the one thing he texts me all the time, and he's at every game, and he just goes, can't win a faceoff when we need it.
Right.
You know, and that's, if you're looking at Achilles heel for them, I think that's where that is. And I think, you know, this is kind of unthinkable to say, but for Yale, if we're looking for that same kind of Achilles heel, that break in the armor that we're looking for, you know, they can get got in transition. And I think that's like the secret way to beat Yale is like, if you can get their midi, like they really only run like one rope unit, and it's a guy, then they have a ton of two-way guys, and they are, I don't care who you are gassed when you're totally. Running so much midfield. So if you can throw a bunch of guys at them and kind of bounce them off and make them expend as much energy as possible, you're going to get a result. I really think you are.
Yeah. My Achilles heel for Yale would be their midfield defense. I think people take for granted, like Yale for 5 years could roll out like Glassini, Ty Warner. Like, I mean, these guys are studs, some of the best in the world. To me, and I will say that I'm biased because in person I watched Brown play their best game and Yale play their worst game, and all of that was driven by midfield initiation. So I'm a little bit perhaps like overskewed. I think Stuzan and the four shorties need to prove to me that they can hold up against kind of big boy tournament type Dodgers and do it with success. Because to me, Buse on film is going to really attack those high wings out of like a Paris type look and force them to make decisions in space. And at the end of the day, like to stop a Paris offense, you have to stop the ball. Like if the short stick can't stop the ball from getting to the middle of the field, especially those lefties, because Cornell has two good lefties. It's going to be a long day. So that would be my call out in terms of their weakness. And then I think Cornell's Achilles heel, honestly, is just their inconsistency. Like until 6 o'clock Friday, I'm going to be fascinated what team gets off the bus. Like, do they carry forward the emotion of Richie Moran and the big win on Saturday into that is their new energy for the rest of the year, and they're a huge problem come tournament time? Or is it kind of that emotional setback of like they used everything they had to beat Princeton, and now the gunpowder's dry? So, yeah, I'm fascinated by that game.
New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal will return after this message.
The Men's Lacrosse Championships, where speed and power meets precision and creativity. and they give it everything they got, from face-off to the final whistle. Go big for every goal. Go beyond your limits and enter the NCAA universe. The Men's Lacrosse Championships, May 28th through 30th at Rentschler Field in East Hartford, Connecticut. Get your seats today at ncaa.com/mlacrosse.
Are you serious about playing your sport in college? Do you need a flexible education that allows you to maintain your practice and competition schedules while also preparing you to succeed at the next level? You should check out the University of Nebraska High School. UNHS is accredited and offers more than 100 online courses, including NCAA-approved courses to protect your academic eligibility. Students could earn a UNHS diploma or take a single course for transfer credit. Courses are college prep, self-paced, and available 24/7, 365. Enroll anytime and take up to a year to complete a course. Visit highschool.nebraska.edu today.
Looking to keep up with all the latest news and information on New England lacrosse? New England Lacrosse Journal and LaxJournal.com are the premier resources for information and inspiration on the New England lacrosse scene. Have every issue of New England Lacrosse Journal, the magazine, delivered to your home or office. And don't forget to stay in the game every day with a digital subscription to LaxJournal.com to receive daily digital lacrosse coverage on club lacrosse, college commits, prep and high school, Division I, II, and III colleges, showcases, rankings, and much more. Get in the game and behind the scenes now by logging on to LaxJournal.com. Just click on the subscribe button and start the subscription that is right for you today. New England Lacrosse Journal is a Siemens Media publication. Siemens Media. Inspiring. Informative. Insightful.
It's a great time to turn it over to the next one. We are going to start with Penn. My notes on Penn are, this is just a straight power shoot your face off team. And I don't know what else I'm looking at when I watch them play, other than this is a team that wants you to try to get in the way of their shots, and they're just going to power down on you. And then when you start coming to close that out, they're just going to bang it and get another shot.
Yeah, Penn's a fascinating group. I mean, if you look at their results, I used to use this term in hockey all the time when I played, but they're the type of club that like plays up to the big boys and plays down a little bit to kind of the tier two, tier three programs. And I think you see that in their scores. I mean, they never really blow anybody out. They were called the Cardiac Quakers for a while this year, and that's not necessarily a good thing, right? It's some teams that you'd hope you could put away, you kind of let hang in. I think they are defined by their athleticism, their size, and their midfield dodging. Like Sam Hanley, regardless of his ups and downs, is a grown man. Like that guy, just watching him in person, the way in which he comes out of dodges and has the ability to plant his feet with both hands and bring heat. He reminds me of Sergio Perkovic, my former teammate. He's really that good. I actually think, to be totally honest with you, a lot of his turnovers, he's making the right play and like the attackman just can't handle it. He comes out of the roll or the split with such pace and just jams it, like throws it as hard as he can. And that leads to a little bit of disconnection. But, you know, I think what's so fascinating about this matchup is Penn's strength offensively is actually Brown's strength defensively. And Brown's strength offensively is also Penn's strength defensively. This is a midfield dodging game. We are going to initiate with Ryan Oghaven. We are going to drive hard at short sticks with the Moschiettis and the Kellys and the Kings. Penn's going to do the exact same thing. Sam Hanley is going to start basically every possession. He's going to come high and hard off of some sort of high wing pick and try and get to the middle. And it's exciting in that this is like a bruising ACC of old type matchup where you get like the Rannigans going downhill in a Hopkins Maryland game. And it's like, can somebody hold up? Like Trevor Yeboah Cody and George Pike have a, like, this is why you play college lacrosse. Like this is a huge responsibility that we're putting on them, that they got to hold up against these guys coming off picks. But I think they can do it. I mean, Penn, I'm impressed by Shipley. I'm impressed by 40. Like he played us well last time around. You know, in terms of our last matchup, to touch on it, Penn looked great early. I mean, they were up 5-0 and, you know, candidly, they could have filled the net a little bit more. I think People's goalie was able to make a couple saves and we were able to chip away at it. But I think in terms of this game, what it will be defined by, and I was there in person at Franklin Field, it's 50-50 wing play. Like both of these faceoff guys didn't really win them clean. It was a lot of like helter skelter and just like slapping and checking and types of ground balls that I used to love being a part of with Tully. So it'll be exciting. I mean, this Birkinshaw kid grew up, he's a really good friend of my brother. He grew up right around the corner from me. He had 17 saves last time we played. You know, we need him to be a little bit off, but he's good. I mean, it's a big boy matchup.
100%. And I think, you know, obviously you're if you're just looking at volume, right? It's actually not Sam Hanley that's taking the most shots on Penn. It's Dylan Gurgar.
Totally.
And he takes them from literally anywhere. I mean, his favorite is to catch it on the curl and just rip, right?
Yeah.
But this guy just does not care who's in front of him. And that's why I actually like that, because I love shooters that just don't care. You know what I mean? Totally. Those are the guys.
That's the way to play, right? Just shoot free. Shoot small. That's the biggest thing, especially on people's goalie, because he's big. No, but to your point, I mean, people come so quick to 26 that what will decide Penn's fate, both in the Ivy tourney and the NCAA tournament, the reality is it's not their best player. Sam Hanley doesn't have the ability to impact the game that way because of how quick people come to him. You know, it will always be that second and third tier option that needs to basically just shoot the hell out of the ball and really fill it to force people to kind of slide slower. And I think what would be fascinating, and obviously I'm not going to tip our hand here, but the way in which we play him, the way in which we decide to either play base or to junk or to play, you know, a little bit of variated base, whether it be man or zone scheme. For those who watched our first matchup, just to touch on it, when we actually started slowing down Penn in the second and third quarter, we were playing a little bit of what I would quantify as like a soft zone, shorties on the pipes, forcing their umbrella midfielders to like overload and make decisions about how they want to shoot the ball. And that's honestly when people's goalies started seeing it and kind of getting hot and kind of turning the tide. And that's when our offense started gaining momentum. So the chess match between offensive and defensive coordinator will be fascinating in this one and to monitor. And I think my prediction would be both sides have new stuff, both offensively and defensively, that they're going to try and throw. This just on paper screams like coin flip. It screams like toss up. And it's not the type of game where, you know, one side just needs to like do their thing and they'll win handily. Like this will be a true test. And I think the coaching staffs are going to try and do everything possible, obviously, to manufacture goals.
This game has two ways of going. Either Penn gets their way and adjusts the tempo and is able to kind of corral Brown and kind of put him in a hurt locker, or the complete opposite happens and Brown just runs wild on them. I think it's probably going to be somewhere in the middle. I mean, when they played recently, it was very much all Penn in the first quarter. Like Brown looked straight up bad. I'm just going to say it. They looked bad. Yep. And then they totally turned it around, started winning some faceoffs with Gonti and went wild, especially in the third. They kind of continued their momentum and Penn really struggled to get good shots because they were switching the matchups and pushing guys out on their shooters. And I think that's going to be kind of the key to victory. If we're not even talking about, you know, Jimmy's and Joe's, X's and O's here, if you're able to kind of put the clamps on Gurgar and Handley, you're probably going to beat Penn. I don't think you can say that for Brown. I think Brown has too many guys that can either get past you or guys that can just cut behind you and finish the ball.
I think that's right. And to build off that, for Penn to win, to me, and this is not really the bias in me, I think Brown is executing at a level offensively that it's going to be very hard to hold us south of 12 goals in any game we play the rest of the year. I think we found a solution, a true problem set that is really challenging for defensive coordinators, which is we come from everywhere. We can dodge with basically every midfielder we trot out there. We attack short sticks. We throw back as our basically starting initiator, and our turnovers have gone way down, and our finishing north-south when we jam it down to McLean and Antonelli and Glavin has gone way up. So for Penn to win, in my opinion, I think they need to score. I do not anticipate this being like an 8-7 type game. I think Brown has found a real mojo and karma on that side of the ball, and specifically Ryan Aughaven. He is playing with a swagger, and he is beating poles with an intensity and a swagger, both on even and up, that I just don't see them stalling out here. I think there's too much kind of falling in their favor. With that being said, just to touch on them, and I'm an LSM guy, as you know, BJ Farrar is phenomenal. That is a very fun matchup for people who love like singular matchups and like are true fans of college lacrosse. 42 versus one this weekend. That is a pro type feel. But with that being said, what Brown does a really good job of is we'll start with Moshe Eddie. We'll get the defense spinning, force people to slide, and we'll get Augie on the matchup we need. So I'm just really excited about it. I'm really looking forward to it. I think a couple of things to call out that I think could also be huge indicators here. We got to stay out of the box. I think this is the type of game where Sam Hanley is too good as a man up umbrella top high guy, and he can just shoot it from too far. I mean, we cannot take penalties. And vice versa, Brown statistically is actually the best man up in the Ivy League. And I think I know a lot of people probably wouldn't guess that, but we're very good and we're very clean. I think Homer does a great job putting McLean specifically in good positions to get his hands free. And he's as good an accuracy shooter as I've seen. Like, he doesn't have the pace that some of the past, you know, high righty wing guys have, but he can place the ball. I mean, he shoots so small. So I think that's going to be a big kind of swing momentum thing, especially early. And then it's just the clamp. I mean, if Gunty or their guy can get to a place where they're keeping the wings out of it and they're winning it early and kind of really establishing tempo, then I think that gets at what you were touching on, where there's kind of those two sides of the spectrum. Brown can start running and really getting going, or Penn can kind of play their game.
Yeah, and I really would not be surprised to see Penn throw a hybrid zone look in here. I mean, they play that a lot anyway, but they're going to want to, again, the key to this game is the tempo. Like, if whoever wins that wins the game. It's really, you know, it's funny because there are so many nuances with both of these games and all four of these teams. There's so many things that can go right and go wrong to determine a victory. But really, you can just put your thumb right on it, you know.
The zone thing for Murph will be fascinating. Typically, the teams that struggle in zone are like super long, athletic, dodging teams. Our attackmen are all like zone players. Like, they're all almost Canadian in influence. Like, Antonelli in the middle is not someone you want floating around. McLean on the pipe, Glavin on the pipe. So when we go into those kind of like lefty righty overloads and we just kind of go into those crash follows. So I think that's why people haven't zoned us, especially over the last month, with the consistency you'd probably expect, is just personnel wise. We're not the team that typically gets zoned, but to your point, it'll be fascinating if Murph tries to throw, to kind of just junk it maybe for every other possession or off end lines, or, you know, the chess match of both of these coaching staffs, I think will be fascinating.
Yeah. I would say it's almost a guarantee that some junk defense is going in here for Penn, like almost guaranteed, and not because they need it, but because part of disrupting Brown is disrupting their rhythm. Right. And if they get four goals in a row, the game's probably over. You know, like if they go on a run where they score four goals in 4 minutes, that means if you don't stop them on the next one, you are losing. And I think Penn is ready for that. I think that's the one thing. Like, if I'm going to give them a lot of credit, I'll give them credit for actually making adjustments in game. Because, yes, the scores are close, but they're close scores. They've only lost one OT game the whole year. They won the other two. You know, they have a bunch of two goal wins, and, you know, they roughed up Albany. You know, those 11 goals that Albany scored were not against starters. So I think, you know, this game is a great clash of styles, whereas Cornell Yale is like, okay, well, you know, the midfield will battle it out and the faceoff guys and the goalies, and like, it's much more traditional in terms of a breakdown. This game is like, you know, do you want to throw a haymaker? Or do you want to throw 100 jabs? You know, and which one wins? You know, it's who can outlast the other team and their game plan, and who can make adjustments. And, you know, I think both coaching staffs are also very good. You know, I didn't know Mike Murphy until this year, and the couple of times I've talked to him, man, that's a smart dude. I mean, obviously he's an Ivy League school, but he's a really intelligent lacrosse coach, and he always has plans. You know, I said that about Shea earlier, but I think that's Murph too.
No, agreed. I mean, I think the staffs across the board in the Ivy League are really, really strong. And that's kind of why you see the teams represented where they are in the RPI. I'm so excited for the nation to get a look into our new facilities. You know, when I played at Brown, and I love playing at Brown, and Kyle, you were there almost every game. Yep. It was a high school field. Like, it was the press box, like, was almost like falling down. Like, there was no bathrooms. It was just bleachers. And, you know, when we got good in 15, 16, it was actually kind of cool because it was like a Woodstock environment. There was just like students everywhere and people on the hill and all sorts of stuff. But you got to tip the cap to our alumni group and the ability to fundraise for that new stadium, that building, and put us in a position to compete with the big boys in recruiting. And, you know, when you walk into Coach Dale's office now, and I'm sure you'll see it like next time you're there. I mean, it feels like Nick Saban's. Like, it's super nice. The stadium's really nice. Like, it's got the full amenities, the suite. And it's such a cool opportunity to host and put on this type of spectacle, because it's going to be packed out. There's such a buzz because of the strength of the Ivy League. And I expect the environment on Friday night just to be absolutely ripping and roaring. So I'm really excited for the nation to get a look.
100%. And, you know, Brown was one of my favorite places to go before it was cool. So right. it's like finding the band that you supported, and now they're like really good and everyone loves them. And you're like, no, I was there
right
10 years ago, man. I was there for the first album, man. Where were you?
Yeah.
That's right. Literally how I feel about Brown, and in the best way, right? Like, I really enjoy getting down to Providence, great area, great campus. And the only problem is parking, which
totally,
let's figure it out, guys. Just go take down that cemetery or something and like put up a parking lot. I don't know. Yeah. It's probably not the move, but there's gotta be, you've got enough money, just buy some houses and knock them down and make a parking lot, because no one has anywhere to park. Gripes aside, before we make our picks, let's look at what happens to the bracketology of this.
Yeah.
Sure. Right. So do you think Ivy is a 5-bid league?
I think the only way it wasn't was if Princeton was in the tournament. I think if Brown was in the 5 spot and we were a more of like a bubble type team, I think Princeton being out and in the 5 seed almost guarantees, because of their strength in the RPI. And I just think with the strength of the conference, it becomes really challenging as a committee to leave out individually any team that's in the Ivy League tournament. I mean, when you look at where they sit in terms of RPI, strength of schedule, top 5, top 10, top 20 RPI wins, like mathematically, when you just like take the logos away, it's so hard to make an argument that either Penn, Cornell, Yale, or Brown should not be part of the at-large process. So to me, I think 5 is a guarantee. I think Harvard, unfortunately, is going to be that classic case of like they did everything right and they just lost a 1-goal game here or there, and they're probably going to miss. Because I just don't see a world where they get in over the winner of Duke Notre Dame or the winner, obviously, of Rutgers Ohio State. But in terms of the bracketology implications, and I was talking to the boys about this week when I was texting with Augie and McLean, I mean, there's never been more to play for. I think if you win Friday, you guarantee not only a home game, but you could argue that you guarantee a top 6 seed. I think I think if Brown Penn, the winner of Brown Penn is probably top 6 seed. I think the winner of Cornell Yale is definitely a top 6 seed. So I think the only like curveball in all this is Penn, because they're so high in the RPI. I think eye test and like just like current feeling and some of the human elements is that it's hard to seed them. I don't know where to place them, especially if they lose. I think the committee in the top 10 they put out was Penn 8 that they put out during the Harvard Yale game. So I think if they lose, I could see them traveling in round one. The other thing for your listeners that's really important to consider, this is a really fascinating challenge in terms of travel because of how many Ivy League teams are going to be in. And you're only supposed to use 2 planes and like the 400-mile rule. And
sure.
Like, who is able to go where and like what are the appropriate matchups is going to be really interesting. And my prediction would be, once you get below Maryland and Georgetown, I think it's going to be a lot more human element in terms of like where they slot who, because of just the need to get short bus trips. So like one thing I'm really hoping for, if Brown can win on Friday night and BU wins the Pat League, I think there's a very realistic chance they send BU to Brown, which to me would be great instead of playing like Duke or Notre Dame, because those are the types of things that come into this. They've always come into it. But obviously we don't want to get ahead of our skis, but that's what I think's at play. So Friday, bracketology wise, winner has a home game, loser heads to the bubble of hosting versus on the road in round one, which is actually a very challenging place to be, because there's some really good teams that are going to land in that 7, 8, 9, 10 range. Like Notre Dame is a massive elephant, I think. Like somebody is going to, and remember, they can't go to Virginia, as much as I wish they would go to Virginia and beat up on Lars. But they can't do it. So it's going to be fascinating. This bracket's so interesting.
Yeah, I'll be honest. I mean, I was the one who was like, it's not a 5-bid league for like 6 months or whatever it was, or 6 weeks. And now like every result went the way of the Ivy League, including the ones against themselves, where there really isn't much of a choice. My hot take on it is I think if Penn loses, they become the fifth and Princeton becomes the four, regardless of who made the tournament, the Ivy League tournament.
You're saying in terms of the ordering? Definitely. Yes. Like I actually think Princeton could get as high as two. Like I more just mean pre-tournament when you slot them into the fifth, it's just so hard to keep the four in out, but you're totally right. I think Princeton will get credit for Georgetown and Rutgers, especially if Rutgers beats Ohio State. I think where the bubble becomes a lot more interesting is if Ohio State slaps around Rutgers. I think that entire dialogue of where Rutgers then slides to in the RPI and what that does to everyone's math.
Yeah.
Because remember, Rutgers' strength of schedule is like stunningly low.
Yes. Like, yes.
And if you actually look at their resume, it's like not that strong when you compare it side by side to some of the other bubble teams. Do I think they'll get in? I do. I do think they'd be a bubble in team. I don't see them falling all the way out because of where they were in the committee seating. But like when you actually just take away the logos and look at the math, like if you look at Rutgers side by side with Harvard, mm-hmm. if Rutgers gets smacked by Ohio State, like Harvard's got a way better strength of schedule. They're going to be above them in the RPI probably. So it's just interesting.
Yeah. I think, you know, obviously I like to call them, what's the word? The hobbyist, the casual lacrosse fan.
Yeah.
They're all up in arms about, you know, oh, the Ivy League's not as good as the ACC. Like, why is the ACC not getting respect? Why are they not as good? And it's like, listen, man, tradition doesn't last forever. Okay.
Yeah. I don't understand. Like, you can't complain about a system that's benefited you. I think Terry Foyd, Inside the Cross, put up the statistics from UNC when they got into the tournament in 2016 and won. Like, they would be not even close to a bubble out team this year. They would be not even on the bubble. Like, the system that is protecting the Ivy this year and everyone's up in arms about is what has protected the bubble ACC teams and the bubble Big Ten teams for generations. Like, literally all of the 8-6 teams from the ACC that have gotten into the tournament are all directly because of the math that everyone is now complaining about. So, yeah, are there holes in the math? Of course. But the committee's job, it's not like the Supreme Court. Like, the committee's job isn't to overturn precedent. It's just to, like, block and tackle and listen to, like, the bullet points that they were given. And these are the bullet points. So unless we change them, you know, they're going to do the exact thing they always do. They're going to start with RPI, and then they're going to work down the list and fill the bracket.
Yeah, I just think eye test doesn't even matter anymore. I just think it's not even a starter. But if it was, that's why I think Penn would be five. And Harvard, that Harvard game against Penn really decided all of this.
Yeah, it did. Harvard, I mean, to Harvard's credit, like, they beat Brown, and Brown kept getting better, so that result looks better. They beat Princeton. It's a huge win. And they also didn't lose to anybody bad. Like, we have a rock in our RPI math, which is the UMass result. Like, it's just sinking our RPI. Like, Harvard, I think, lost to, like, Ohio State. They lost to Yale, right? They lost to, like, Penn and Cornell. Like, those are – that's – honestly, when you read those out, that is the type of schedule from, like, an ACC team that typically gets you in, if those are your only losses. So, you know, it's just – honestly, it's just a tough year. And I do feel bad to a degree for the Harvard guys. And Princeton luckily did enough early that their late season slide won't cost them. They're still going to host a home game. But I will say, Princeton a week ago would have played like the winner of Vermont and St. Bonaventure. Mm-hmm. And now they're going to play like they could play Notre Dame. So it has very serious implications in terms of the seeding for Princeton.
I mean, with the way the NCAA works, it's just going to be Rutgers so they can stay in New Jersey.
Right. Exactly.
Let me ask you one quick question before we make our picks. Is this the best season in the history of the Ivy League?
Yeah, I don't think it's close. I mean, to me, and I'm a hockey guy, like, to me, the best part about the Stanley Cup playoffs is the parity. Like, the 8 seed can beat the 1 seed. How can you not be a fan of – this is not the best individual talent year, right? Like, the Rob Pinellas and the Tom Schreibers and the iconic Princeton teams and all of the great players in the history of Ivy League lacrosse. But how can you not be excited by the concept that the 6th team in the Ivy League literally, you could argue, is as good as the first? Like, the battle to me to get into the Ivy tournament this year was so fun to watch. It made every regular season game can't miss TV. And that to me defines a healthy league. And I think there's no question this is the most powerful the conference has ever been. And I think you'll see it in recruiting. I think you'll see it in facilities and investment. And Ivy League lacrosse could not be in a better position. So no question, I think it's the best year of all time.
All right, let's make our picks. Game 1, Cornell versus Yale. Who you got?
Okay. as a caveat, I have all the respect in the world for Andy Shea, and I think he deserves the benefit of the doubt. He's been very good in Ivy League tournaments if you look at his personal win-loss record. With that being said, I think midfield defense is an Achilles heel. I think Cornell finds a way on the offensive end. I like Cornell 15-12 over Yale.
Wow. Even with a score. I'm going to tell you that I'm going to go the other way. And the only reason I'm going the other way is because Jack's not on the podcast. And if he was on the podcast, I definitely would be a coward and pick Cornell. But I'm going to go with Yale just because I think the game planning is too advanced. I think their ability to adjust and the onus that the freshmen have undertaken on this team is so powerful. I think that is part of the thing that pushes them. And listen, when everything's equal, and I say this all the time, when I hate making picks, but this is how I make a pick if I'm not really decided or if I'm weighing both options. Best player available is Matt Brandau. So that's why I pick Yale. I think it'll be close. I think it'll probably be, I'm going to go 12-10 because I think that Yale finds a way to kind of hold them down a little bit, hold them under the water.
Okay, I like that. Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think it could go either way. I think to your point, if Yale does win, it'll be for those reasons, and I could see that type of score. I think if Cornell wins, it's because they're able to stretch that defense and they'll fill the net.
All right, I know you're picking Brown anyway, but tell me why.
Yeah, so I'm definitely taking Brown. I think at the end of the day, when you think about like tournament time, it's who's playing best, you know, come May. And I think if you look at the Brown sample size over the last 4 weeks, it's really hard to argue that the momentum and the energy that midfield group and the pace at which they're filling the net against really good teams. Like they looked Andy Shea in the eye and they put 20 in on him and it didn't even look like we broke a sweat. Like we went to Cornell, a traditionally incredibly hard place to play, and we ran away from them. Like they didn't even really get close other than that second quarter run. I thought Bryant, we might stumble midweek and like just show a little bit of inconsistency. We didn't. We ran away from Mike Pressler, one of the best coaches in the game. I think Brown has all the energy, momentum, and intensity on their side. I expect Ryan Augaven to be a leader and a captain and to be able to beat a pole. I think we fill the net. I think we run away from them. I think Penn will make it a game because I have a lot of respect for Murph and the talent in that midfield group. I think Hanley will have like 3-3, but I think Brown's going to win 17-15.
Oh, wow. You think they get 15?
I do. Yeah, I think because to your point, my expectation is that Brown builds a little bit of an early lead. Like I think we almost flipped the script from the game at Franklin Field. Mm-hmm. And because of that, Penn's going to have to go into a 10 man against the people's goalie and kind of stretch everything out. And I think it'll be a little more up and down. So I think that's why I think if Penn was on the winning side, I think the score would be far lower. I think because the way in which Brown wins is they need you to kind of play at their tempo. I think Trevor Yeboah Cody and George Pike could have some transition goals. I expect this to be up and down. And a little bit of a tip the cap to some of those Tufts teams in the 2016 Brown team. And honestly, I think the environment's going to be banana lands. I think it's going to be rocking and rolling and can't wait to watch.
Yeah, I'm going to pick a similar score. I might go a touch lower. I think it's probably, I'm going to go with Brown for all the reasons you stated. And because like it's a machine, it's a wagon. You know, it's really hard to pick against Bruno going into the game. They've just looked so good. They've come so far. And I think people don't understand. I tried to emphasize that the beginning of the year was bad. Like it was borderline really disappointing. And, you know, watching the Vermont game sticks in my head, man. I know it was a long time ago, but watching Vermont just like get the ball back and score and basically run out of time instead of losing the game was impactful for me. But I will say Brown's offense is just on another level right now. They're clicking and humming. It's really going to be hard to stop them. And I think it's going to be 15. I think Penn gets a 10. I think it's going to be 15-10. I think it's going to be decided by the start of the fourth quarter. And I think it's going to be, you know, a battle. And I really think that Brown's ability to outshoot, outrun, and outride people is what separates them as an Ivy League power and a power nationally that I think is very somehow, some way, very underrated.
Love it. Absolutely love it. Go Bruno, baby.
All right. It's a great place to end it. We want to thank you again for listening to New England Lacrosse Journals, Chasing the Goal podcast. I'm Kyle Devitt for Steve Saffron and Jack Piattelli. you know, sorry, we picked again. Sorry, I picked against your team and your son. But I love John. So, John, you're going to have a great game no matter what. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Also, listen to the podcast on the website, laxjournal.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at NELaxJournal, Instagram at New England Lacrosse Journal, Lax Journal on Facebook, and our email address, chasingthegoal@laxjournal.com. Join us again next time as we go chasing the goal. Chasing the Goal, a Siemens Media podcast.